82 DIF, K2RI will be in the tech net.
Sort of dizzy.
I'm afraid, but let's give it a try. And if you're willing to hang around, Rich, later on, if this situation comes up, I will be able to give you more information on this. You're allowed to come back in the future weeks and ask your question again, Brady. You've got a darn good question. KD2-TIF, K2RIW, and the TechNet. I hope some of that information helps. You got it, Brady.
Getting missed.
And they think they're saying L-I-W. It's Romeo India Whiskey. It's my call letters. Kilo 2. allowed to meet FCC rules for that kind of long range tag. The longest range tags run at 915 megacycle frequency region. There are tags that run at 2 gigs, 5 gigs. There are tags that run at 13.56 megahertz. There are tags that run at 125 kilohertz. But the long range ones, the longest range ones to date, all run at 915. You don't want to tune the antenna to any other frequency. Like, in theory, you could use European standards and you could make one that runs in the 450 megacycle region, which is not allowed in the United States, but in some countries in Europe they are. And they get a different amount of range out of those. So in order to meet the FCC rules for your reader, you're going to run for the long range type 915 megs in the United States, that region. So there's various ways that you can take your particular tag. If you insist on using your particular tag that's made for a window glass of an automobile, let me drop. You could put it on any other material you care about, wood, plexiglass, or whatever. And there are ways that you can add a sheet of metal nearby of just the right size near the antenna to add capacitance to the tips of the antenna, simulating the presence of the window glass, bringing it right back to resonant frequency. We, as ham radio operators, can build a dipole of any size we want, put it in any environment we want, and we use the tricks that are in our bag of tricks. You can force that antenna electronically to resonate at your favorite frequency. We ham radio operators are damn good at that, and I guarantee that DIF can do that if he wants to spend the time. So you can force the particular tags you want to re-resonate on any material you can mount them on if you use the right tricks. I wonder if that helps what you're looking for, Brady. KD2DIF, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, as long as you're correcting me on the call sign, I'll correct you on the name. The name is Bradley, not Brady. Or please just call me Brad, because the only people who call me Bradley are my mother when she's angry at me. The real question is actually getting away from RFID tags, which is, can we use this kind of technology? You know, you say, you know, we ham radio operators are great, we can build antennas pretty much anywhere, anytime, but apartment life doesn't really lend itself to that. So the question becomes, can things like insulated windows and that sort of thing be used as radiators?
I think the answer is no. Any kind of an antenna that I'm familiar with rare exception, consists of a radiating system that's made of conducting materials. Now, the word conducting in some cases is a little bit weird. In theory, a squirt of water coming out of a hose connected to the right kind of electronics, the water itself has enough conductivity to become a temporary antenna. That's an exception to the usual rules. Most of the antennas you and I build have real copper or aluminum rods or wire or whatever, conducting materials. Now, at microwave frequencies, there's something called a dielectric rod antenna on microwave frequencies. It's a subset of a kind of radio equivalent of an optical lens. But at 915 megacycles, for the most part, any antenna you build at 915 megs primarily is going to consist of conducting materials. It could be aluminum tape, copper tape, wire, copper, aluminum, whatever, neodymium even. Conducting, usually metallic materials. So can you make the glass of a window itself the antenna without adding anything to the glass? The answer is almost no. Without some very exotic techniques, the answer is definitely a no, as I see it. You got to use conductors, Brad.
Yeah, you know, I don't having to add a exploited on the sentences of yours where we're in a situation where there is a limit to where you can move an antenna. If you can actually IW. I'll be there.
All right, thank you. Okay, that signal is hitting S9 at my location. It's getting closer. Brady, I heard most of what you said. You're allowed to come back and ask those questions as many times as you want in future weeks, because you've got a very interesting set of projects that you could develop there for what I think you're... The next person on our list was Steve, K-A-Q-I-H-Y. And I'm hoping that those guys in Malvern can put out a strong enough signal to get over this stuff. Go right ahead, Steve, K-A-Q-I-H-Y, K-A-Q-I-H-Y in the TechNet.
Okay, let's see if this is making it. I really didn't have a question, Dick. I just wanted to tell you about that book. It is an ARRL publication, and it's called The Power Supply Handbook, and it has your amplifier in it.
Very fine, Steve. So ARRL, that power supply, with my amplifier in it. Glad to hear that. Okay. Sounds good, Steve. Hey, well, we're 15 minutes late on our quasi-premise of an hour for the introductory questions that we try to answer everybody's question at least briefly during the first hour of those who sign in, and we take them in the order in which they came to us. John, you've got 2 weeks worth of mailbag questions to bring us up to date on. So we got some catching up to do, John. KD2, here we go. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Glad to have you back, John. K2RIW listening.
KC2WGB, how copy, Dick?
Fantastic, please proceed.
Good evening to everyone on the net. We have a question that has been waiting, which involves an antenna question of a fluorescent tube. This gentleman wants to ignite a fluorescent tube, power it up, and he wants to place a coil on it of the right impedance, couple that to his transmitter. Plasma in the tube is an antenna. He'd like to know what you think about that, and what should he expect? So maybe you can give him some words on that. KC2WGB.
Okay, you sounded good, John. And I'm getting a jamming signal with S9 at my location, which I should be reporting at RFI at LiveArc.org. Okay, there were a couple of projects I'm familiar with where a fluorescent tube became the temporary antenna. Quite a few projects have done that. I'm familiar with a few of them. The way a fluorescent tube works is that it's got a mercury vapor inside, among other substances. High voltage is applied between the two ends. The mercury vapor inside becomes a conducting plasma. The conducting plasma, with current flowing through it, gives off primarily ultraviolet signals. The ultraviolet signals hit the phosphor that's on the glass of the fluorescent tube. The phosphor gives off, it converts the ultraviolet signal into a visual signal, and you see the white light coming out of the tube. But the presence of the conducting plasma inside the tube, the mercury vapor, is a definite conducting material that can be made into a dipole-like antenna. And a number of projects have done just that. Let me give you an example. One really crazy application of that would be a selfie antenna. If you put a dipole antenna on the side of your very low radar cross-section antenna, an FC1...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
An FA-117 bomber, for instance, or a B-2 bomber, you put a dipole antenna on that. The dipole antenna itself will give you a radar echo that could be lots of decibels stronger than the echo you get from the hold-on aircraft. Therefore, putting an antenna on a stealthy aircraft, a low radar cross-section aircraft, is something you better do very carefully, because you may have just made that airplane light up like gangbusters on somebody's radar screen, if you know what I mean. However, if your antenna consists of an electronically excitable antenna, like fluorescent tubes, now, when the fluorescent tube is turned off, it's radio-wise transparent, gives you no echo, doesn't degrade the performance of your stealthy airplane. And for brief periods of time, when you think it's safe, you excite the fluorescent. antenna. That's just one crazy application I can think of. So can you make an antenna out of a fluorescent tube? Absolutely. And that could be some very interesting experiments. By the same token, we amateurs have on occasions taken a fluorescent tube, put it near our antenna, watch it light up from a radio, or to put it near the high voltage of the, to put it near the cap of a vacuum tube that's running at say, for instance, 80 meters or 40 meters. I can remember doing that. You got to be careful with that one. You don't want to be holding on to the metal ends of the tube because when it lights up, the high voltage one end here could be now being conducted to your hand on the other end. But can a fluorescent tube be made into an antenna? Absolutely. Been done multiple times. And it may not be a perfect antenna, but it does work. Maybe that's some of the answer you're looking for, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, good answer. I'm sure you can have a lot of fun with that. I was wondering myself. It sounds like something that would work. How efficient it would be, I would imagine it probably depends on the frequency range, which he didn't tell me. It's a 48-inch tube, so maybe he's working. I'm going to try 2 meters, 6 meters, somewhere around there. Don't know, but interesting. Okay, now let me pick up my book here and give you a construct for the next question. KC2WGB.
And by the way, even though that tube is 48 inches long, once again, we amateurs are smart enough to take a finite physical length of an antenna, and by various techniques, impedance matching, top hat capacitors, loading coils, helical winding, zigzagging, there's a whole lot of techniques by which we can take something that is physically too short or too long at the antenna frequency that we want it to operate at, and we can force it to operate electronically at our frequency. So he can use that 48-inch long fluorescent tube at almost any frequency he wants if he's smart enough to apply some of those other techniques, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Absolutely. I agree with that. You know, tuning of your transmission is great, but now to use it as a receiver, reciprocity might have some problem with the amount of noise on the receiver. But you'll have to work on that. But transmitting, yeah, I can see that working. Sounds good.
Let me add a couple of words to that one, John. You've hit on a very good point. The very earliest noise diode that was used for microwave work literally consisted of a small fluorescent tube mounted at a slanting angle, a very shallow angle, in a piece of waveguide. You drilled a hole in the top and the bottom of a waveguide at a slanted angle, and you put a fluorescent tube in there, and you light up the fluorescent tube inside of the waveguide, and it produces a very predictable amount of radio noise, and that radio noise that you can electronically turn on and off 400 times per second with a square wave is the exact way of operating a automatic noise figure indicator. So a fluorescent tube does produce not a lot, but a predictable amount of noise on a radio receiver. Transmitter-wise, you would never know it's there. Receiver-wise, it does produce noise, obvious by the way they were used on that particular application. And there are ways you can quiet that noise, make it less. You can never make it go to zero, because that plasma, whenever you've got current flowing through a plasma, it is a whole lot of individual ionized element, molecules, or whatever. They're bouncing around the way they want to while current is flowing through them. You can see that there's mechanisms there of making a kind of very broadband random noise. So receiver-wise, it could be troublesome, and you hit on a good point there, John.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, now you've got me into asking this question, being that you mentioned that. Why is the fluorescent tube in the waveguide at an oblique angle? Why at an angle and whatnot? Why not perpendicular to the walls?
Oh, there's a whole art and science to that one, John. You and I could decide in our piece of waveguide, I'm going to make a dummy load, out of the carbon granule loaded piece of rubber that literally is a tire that I took off my automobile. I take a tire off my automobile, I cut it up with a pair of tin snips, I get some of that black rubbery material, even with the cleats, and you mount that into a piece of waveguide, and it is a dummy load, but there's a catch. Whenever you put a dummy load in a waveguide, if the material you put in the waveguide just happens to have an impedance of 377 ohms at your operating frequency, yes, it does. But there's a much better way. You can take any material you want, water, plastic, rubber, carbon granules, whatever, anything you put into a piece of waveguide, if it's at a very gentle slanting angle, so that when you look down the waveguide, you either see a very shallow angled wedge of material, or you see a sharp pointed material. No matter what the material is made out of, in fact, some of the best waveguide dummy loads I have ever made are made out of a piece of ordinary 3/4 inch diameter wooden dowel. Call it a broomstick handle if you like. Put a piece of broomstick handle down a piece of round 3/4 inch copper pipe that you buy at Home Depot, because you're doing experiments where the 3/4 inch pop-up copper pipe is a beautiful piece of waveguide. Let me drop. The 3/4 inch copper pipe that you buy at Home Depot is some of the world's best waveguide, round waveguide, for the 10 gigacycle ham band, 10 gig ham band. 10.368 gigahertz is the usual frequency, and that piece of round pipe is just properly tuned for that, if you know what I mean. And as you're building various circuits out of that round copper pipe that you bought at Home Depot, occasionally you want a dummy load, and you take an ordinary piece of 3/4 inch round pipe, which you pirate call, and if you sharpen one end of it like a pencil, and if you make the tapered end like a pencil long enough, about 3 inches long with a sharp enough point, and you ram that into one end of this round pipe, and then you measure how much reflected signal you get off of that dummy load. And why should a round piece of wood be a dummy load? And the answer is it contains moisture, water. And water is a very interesting RF absorber at radio frequencies. And if you want to make sure it has the exact same amount of absorption, you paint it with lacquer or some other substance to make sure that the water content of your dowel stays the same. But you shove that dowel into one end of that pipe, and then you measure the reflection coefficient, as I have done. And if you've got a sharp enough point and a gentle enough taper of that dowel in the waveguide, you will get a reflection coefficient 35 dB down. That's a vizoir of around 1.02, if you know what I mean. So as long as you taper the material, you put, even if it's only slightly lossy, as long as you properly taper the material you put into a piece of waveguide, it becomes a perfect dummy load. The impedance match happens automatically. The science behind that is something darn interesting. So there's a huge advantage of tapering materials you put into a piece of waveguide. Tack that into the back of your brain and remember it, John. KC2WGB, I'm having fun with you.
Repeater, timeout.
Yeah, my brain's full of thumbtack holes, Dick. Dick, how does that affect the group delay response coming back?
Okay, first of all, the 35 dB down reflection signal, which is an extremely strong reflection for that tapered piece of wood in the waveguide. If you now use a network analyzer and you're trying to measure distance to fault, as it's called, in other words, you want to find out where is the reflection coming from in that tapered piece, and the answer is distributed. You've hit on a very good point here. Is it the sharp point that's giving you some echo? Yes, very little. Is it the very beginning of the sharp point as you go down the sides? Is that giving you echo? Yes. Is it the base giving you echo? Yes. You're getting a little bit of echo across the whole darn length, but the total composite echo is very, very small. So if you built a bullet-shaped attenuator, in other words, in your round piece of waveguide, you want to build, let me say, a 6 dB attenuator, and you build a double-sided pencil out of wood. You take a chunk of wood that's 8 inches long, and you put a pencil sharpening end on the left side and the right side, and you shove that down a piece of waveguide, and you properly calibrate it, and it becomes a 6 dB attenuator. And you're now asking the question, the signal that flows through that tapered 6 dB attenuator? Is it being shifted in time and being smeared in the time domain and being dispersed? The answer is a little bit, but so is the waveguide doing that to you. Let me drop it. One of the things you have to accept is the fact that any radio signal going down a waveguide bounces back and forth between the narrow walls. Common sense would lead you to believe the signal is going to float right straight down the middle of the guide, just like your eyesight does when you've got an open-ended piece of waveguide. Uh-oh, that's not what the radio wave does. You take a piece of WR90 waveguide rectangular 90 is what that stands for. It's 9/10 of an inch major dimension inside, 0.45 inch in the other dimension. That piece of waveguide is carefully tuned, you could say, to operate between 8.4 and 12.4 gigahertz. As you swish across that frequency, the exact angle that those signals bounce back and forth between those walls is very exact at each and every frequency. As you go to a higher and higher frequency, the angle of the bounce becomes more and more shallow. But there's an exact bounce angle of every single bounce of the signal going down that guide. Therefore, the waveguide has a different electronic length as you change frequency. The electronic length gets longer and longer as you go to a lower and lower frequency because it bounces at a sharper and sharper angle as you go to a lower frequency. It doesn't propagate forward as much on each bounce. So every piece of waveguide is dispersive, and that's a problem. Let me drop. A few buddies of mine were proposing to put a 1,000-foot-high radio tower on top of Todd Hill in Richmond County, in Staten Island, where you live, and they were going to put the transmitters at the base of that tower. A piece of waveguide, whether it be round or rectangular, almost doesn't matter, was going to go up to 1,000 feet of tower, and the broadcasting was going to take place from the top of that tower, and that was going to be a broadcast center until the new World Trade Center was reestablished. And I remember indicating to them that, have you realized what's going to happen with 1,000 feet of waveguide? No matter how perfectly you build that waveguide, the dispersion it has, the way the bounces change as a function of frequency, is going to take your beautiful, carefully composed television signal, particularly a digital television signal, it's going to smear it in the time domain as a function of frequency. A television signal is 6 megacycles wide. And if the bottom of the 6 megacycle signal arrives considerably later than the top of the 6 megacycle wide signal at the top of the waveguide, and you transmit that signal without compensating for all of that, you ain't got a coherent transmission anymore. So every piece of waveguide is dispersive. And then the amount of dispersion gets worse and worse as it gets longer and longer. And if in any installation you propose to use 1,000 feet of waveguide, you better consider some other approach. There's only 5 ways that that can kill you, even though on paper it looks beautiful. Over to you, John, K2RAW.
Yeah, better with hardline and use a small amount of waveguide at the top if you need a swivel joint or something like that. Yeah, that's understood. Well, now I just have, excuse me, but I have one more question. Because if we're going on with the tapered plug that you would put into the waveguide, the effect that it's having in the waveguide, would that be considered the reciprocal of the anechoic material?
If you look at the usual way a radio anechoic chamber is built, and quite often also the acoustic anechoic chambers, the stuff on the walls, we call it pyramids, very spiky pyramids made out of polyurethane foam with carbon granules inside. The reason for those pyramid-shaped objects is that, once again, a tapered material becomes an extremely efficient absorber with very little reflection if it's done right across the right frequency range proportional to the size of the pyramids. As you build your microwave anechoic chamber at lower and lower frequencies, those pyramids must be taller and taller. By the time you get down to a good microwave anechoic chamber runs very nicely at 10 gigahertz. And if you want to build a chamber at 1 gigahertz and lower, the size of those pyramids gets so big, the material becomes so expensive, it starts leaning over on the walls, if you know what I mean. It starts tilting, it starts sagging, and so it becomes very troublesome, and you've got to periodically, there are very few anechoic chambers that have any reasonable performance at 1,000 megacycles or lower unless you use some of the very exotic materials from the absorber on the walls, which are very expensive. A combination of ferrite plus radial loading. I can't think of the name of the material. MagRAM, it's called. Magnetic radio absorbing material. So very exotic, expensive magnetic radio absorbing material you could use at lower frequencies. But the usual pyramid types, it has to get very big. So you use the pyramid because you get very little echo. You get very little, you get a lot of absorption from a pyramid. What's really going on here? Let me drop. It's a little bit similar to what happens with, if you put a lobster in a pot of water and then start heating up the pot of water, and if you heat up the pot of water slow enough, maybe he doesn't know he's in hot water, if you know what I mean. The same thing with a radio wave. No matter what you do with a radio wave, if you do it slowly enough, the wave doesn't know the difference. If I started off with a piece of 50-ohm coax cable, which has got around a 2.5-to-1 ratio between the center conductor and the outer diameter, that's what determines that it's 50 ohms, the ratio of those diameters. And if I wanted a piece of coax cable of 10-ohm impedance instead of 50-ohm impedance, which means I'm going to use a much fatter center conductor compared to the outer conductor. If I slowly taper the waveguide, the coaxial cable, if I slowly taper the diameter of the center conductor versus the outer conductor over a number of wavelengths, I will get no reflection. I will get nearly perfect impedance match from 50 ohms down to 10 ohms in my example, and it would be a very broadband match. By comparison, if I had a very rapid step function, where I stepped from one diameter of center conductor to the larger diameter of the 10-ohm coaxial cable, if I did it as a step function, I'd get a huge echo from it, and it would not be a very good impedance-matching device. And even if I did use various techniques for impedance-matching it, by putting another one a quarter wave downrange and so on, it would be very narrowband. So whatever you do with RF, whether you do it in free space, in a piece of coax cable, in a piece of waveguide, you can taper the dimensions of a piece of waveguide to make it go from one impedance to another. If you do it slow enough, the RF doesn't know the difference, it doesn't give you any echo, and you get a broadband impedance match. Ain't that crazy? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB, extremely interesting. I'm going to assume then that even a TDR would not detect that taper if it was done properly. And one other thing, you've never mentioned the testing that you've done in that chamber. Were you able to notice an elevation in the temperature of the absorption material?
Oh boy, did you excite an interesting story. One of the things that Airborne Instruments Laboratory used to produce is the jamming pods for the EA-6B standoff jammer airplane, Navy airplane, carrier-based airplane. That airplane can carry four of these pods, two on the left wing, two on the right wing. Each pod is mounted on a pylon connected to that wing. And we're talking quite a few thousand pounds of hardware in each one of these pods. And the front end of each one of these pods has got a propeller called a ram air turbine. When that airplane is flying at, let me pick a number, 350 miles an hour, the air coming into that ram air turbine can produce lots of kilowatts of electrical power, which powers the transmitter that's inside that pod. The transmitter inside the pod can run, I won't tell you how much, but a whole lot of power, gallons of power by ham radio standards, if you know what I mean. That transmitter is one of the most powerful transmitters the Navy owns that is allowed to be mounted on an airplane. Okay? We build those pods. We, AIL, back in the dark ages, were building those pods. A naive individual, who shall remain nameless, was deciding to test one of those pods. They normally are mounted on a very fancy frame, put in the middle of an anechoic chamber. You take all the people out of the chamber, you close the door, you turn on the pod, and you make the measurements. Well, for a whole bunch of reasons, that stand was not available one particular day. The guy needed something to mount the pod on. He saw a chunk of foam over on one side of the wall. He picked up that chunk of foam, put it in the middle of the chamber, and physically put this 1,000-pound or 2,000-pound, whatever it was, pod on top of that chunk of foam and said, hey, that's an insulating material. I can turn on the transmitter. That particular chunk of foam he picked up was a piece of walk-on RAM. What it really was those pyramids of absorbed
repeater. Time out.
It was those pyramids of absorbing material packed inside of another piece of polyurethane foam with a hard plastic surface on top. So it became material that was absorbing material that you could put on the floor of an anechoic chamber and people could walk on it, but it still was absorptive. So he picked up this piece of absorbing material. He didn't know that. It was a nice block of material. It was probably 3 foot high. Mounted it in the middle of the chamber, put this pod on top of it, walked out of the chamber, closed the door, and turned on the transmitting pod. The transmitting pod put out its zillions of watts of power. It was coming out of the radome of the side of the pod, going into that anechoic material, absorbing it. Obviously, the anechoic material was getting hot. It had no way of dissipating the energy. The bottom line was it caught on fire. The bottom line is, oh, let me take a number. $1 million worth of electronics was the pod that burned down. The pad it was sitting on burned down. It caught the fire to the whole darn chamber. This multi-million dollar chamber burned down. That was one of the biggest fires that AIL ever had. It created all kinds of problems because here's this secure area with lock fences all over the place, and you got firemen on the outside trying to get through the fence in order to put out this fire. They eventually had to mow down the fence to get in there. The firemen now are trying to put out this fire in this great big anechoic chamber, one of the biggest ones on Long Island. I mean, they're trying to put out this fire in this biggest, most expensive chamber on Long Island. The firemen standing off at one side, squirting water into this fire, didn't realize that they were standing in the vicinity of polyurethane foam that was burning, which gives off cyanide-bearing gases. So you had fences that had to be mowed down, a multi-million dollar chamber that burned to the ground, firemen that are trying to put out a fire, and I'll bet you at least five, if not more, of those firemen became extremely sick. All of that is because anechoic material will absorb RF energy, and when it does it, it gets hot. Are you getting the picture here, John? And I was there that day watching that procedure. I watched the in other words, I wasn't working in the chamber. I was working in a laboratory 200 yards away. I heard about the fire and started looking at what's going on. And I was around during the analysis of what the heck happened, who did what, when, and how did this occur. And there's a whole bunch of stories on this one. KC2WGB. Hey, John, does anechoic material absorb RF energy and get hot? That's the method it does it. K2IW, you got it, John.
I remember it well. This is WA2AXO.
Yeah, good old Paul was there that day also. And boy, that was a day we will all remember. Thank you, Paul. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Interesting story, Dick. Yes, I wondered about that, how hot and, you know, how high it could go. So, yeah, that sort of answers the question. Awesome. What an adventure. Must have been a fun place to work. All right, let me get on to the second question. Okay, now this one's going to take probably back and forth a couple of times so that you understand. We have three antennas involved. One is a dish, and it looks like 3 gigahertz is what he's talking about. Okay, so we have this little dish. That dish is pointed directly at a Yagi, which is pointed directly back to the dish. Okay. Then we have a third Yagi. All right, now we start transmitting from the dish to the number 2 Yagi, well, the number 2 antenna, which is the first Yagi, which is receiving. The question is, the third antenna is connected to some type of analyzer, and we are recording the reflected energy from the Yagi that's receiving the signal from the dish. The question is, as the Yagi that's receiving, the number 2 Yagi, as it is receiving and it is tuned perfectly to the frequency, will we notice a dip in the reflected energy off of the antenna by the third antenna. You got the concept?
I'm pretty sure I do. The one thing you haven't told me now is physical locations of things. I'm assuming now that the parabolic dish is mounted in such a way that it's aiming its signal parallel to the ground, dead north. North of the parabolic dish is a Yagi aimed south, aimed into the dish. A little bit further north is a second Yagi also aimed in the dish. Is that approximately the physical layout of what you're describing, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW?
Note the fact that the third antenna, the sampling antenna, is behind the dish, slightly elevated above it so that it can read the reflected signal from the receiving Yagi. So, and it's only a distance, let me see what he had marked here. Looks like a kilometer.
Yeah, you can get some very nice hints about all of this if you go to a website where it's called the K2RIW Corner at the bottom of this website. The website is the Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG. If you go to K5RMG.org, Roadrunners Microwave Group, and on their main page there's something called educational information or technical information. You punch that particular button, you go to that page, and at the bottom of that page there's 10 articles by K2RIW, the K2RIW corner. One of those corners talks about the scattering area of antennas. It's an article broken into three sections, and it's a very interesting characteristic to what you're describing. I'll start at the beginning to give you a little bit of hint of what's going on. Complicated subject. Let me drop. Take an ordinary dipole antenna, any frequency you like. Carefully tune the dipole to be just the right length, and you've done a perfect impedance match. You've got a perfect balance. It's a 70-ohm impedance center of a dipole. You've got a 70-ohm transmission line going through it with a perfect balance. You've got a perfect impedance match. And you use it as a receiving device, and you make some very careful measurements. And I described an experiment in there where you could do this, a thought experiment. And you go to the appropriate chapter of the Bible on antennas, the book by McGraw-Hill, by John Krause. It's called Antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill. You go to the appropriate chapter, and you find out the scattering area of a perfect impedance-matched dipole equals its effective capture area. If your particular antenna had an effective capture area at your frequency of 10 square feet, and you aim a signal at it, and you say, yeah, the amount of signal I absorbed, I know that there's 1 watt per square foot of signal I'm giving to the antenna. The antenna's got 10 watts per square foot. I've got 10 square feet. I got 10 square feet. Therefore, I'm going to pick up 10 watts of signal in my example. So you measure the capture area of the antenna. It's perfectly impedance matched, and you get an answer that makes sense. Then you put it on an antenna range that's made for radar cross-sectional measurements, and you find out that while the antenna is receiving 10 watts of signal, it is also re-radiating 10 watts of signal. You'll say, how in the world does it do that? You mean it really was absorbing 20 watts, it was using the 10 watts and sending it down the cable and re-radiating the other 10 watts into space? Is that what it was doing? The answer is yes. A simple dipole antenna has a scattering area equal to its effective capture area. What's really going on here is Mother Nature doesn't like a disturbance to her uniform materials. You take a really pre-space chunk of real estate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
You take a piece of real estate, a few square yards of air, so to speak, which you're told by the good books has got an impedance of 377 ohms, when you don't put anything into it. You put your beautiful dipole antenna in there that's perfectly impedance matched, you've disturbed the local space. That beautiful uniform material ain't uniform anymore. There is this other, from Mother Nature's point of view, this ugly thing that you call dipole you put into there. Therefore, the radio signal that hits it, some of it's going to be absorbed and some of it's going to be scattered. The scattering equals the absorption. Now, when I flip over from a dipole to a Yagi antenna, the ratio of scattered signal to absorbed signal changes a little bit. But just the presence of a Yagi in free space is giving you some scattering. The scattering is a different amount of scattering in various directions, but it is scattering. scattering the signal in all directions. Then left to discuss it, how much signal it's scattering in that particular direction you're measuring right now, that you're using right now. So the presence of a single Yagi out in front of the dish is a scattering device. It's an absorbing device, it's a receiving device, and you cannot stop it from being a scattering device. Lots and lots of people have spent a good fraction of their lifetime, they spent a good fraction of their lifetime trying to devise an antenna where the absorbing area was 100% and the scattering area, was 0%. You'd be amazed how many people have spent a good fraction of a lifetime looking for the magic antenna that has 100% absorbing antenna and 0% scattering antenna, scattering area. There's a bunch of very fancy physics saying you cannot get there from here. No matter what you do, your antenna is going to do some scattering. In the case of an antenna that's made out of a fluorescent tube, for instance, that you turn on and off, during the time you're not using the antenna, and it's no longer an antenna, you've not turned on the fluorescent tube, yes, you can make the scattering area become very small. But during the time it's an antenna, it is a scattering device. So when you have this Yagi mount parabolic dish, and it's looking at the scattering of the Yagi out in front of the dish, you're going to measure a significant amount of scattering. By the way, I have done that exact experiment at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and there's a whole bunch of stories on that. I personally measured the scattering area of parabolic dishes and Yagi antennas, and if you got the right kind of instrumentation, it's not a super weak signal. You'd be amazed how much scattering you get off of that end. I wonder if that helps, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW. By the way, I'm getting a 60 over 9 signal now in southern Huntington, and this jamming is getting serious. You guys have got to, join us as to reporting these signals, and maybe more of you guys have got to become part of the Fox Hunting crew run by Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar. And you can get to Frankie, you can tell Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar, that you want to join his people that are doing the fox hunting by writing your memo to rfi@limark.org. Okay, yeah, John, KC2WG.
Repeater, timeout.
KC2WGB, K2IW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah. We can use all the help right now that we can get, and it may not be any more than just listening and reporting, like you said. Whatever Bernie thinks he could use, I'm sure he could set people up. That would be great. Okay, the additional question, Dick, was when the sampling antenna, which is behind the dish, is sampling the amount of re-radiated signal or reflected signal off that antenna, when the receiving antenna is tuned to perfect resonance, would we see a dip in the energy, being that now that antenna is absorbing 100% efficiency, I know it's still radiating, but would there be a difference? Would we notice the dip when it comes to perfect resonance?
Yeah, Don, good question. That's exactly the theory of operation of a passive RFID tag. The simple dipole of an RFID tag, by flipping back and forth between a 70-ohm resistor and a short circuit. That's what the little integrated circuit chip does. It does it at a 400 KC rate in some cases, and it's sending back to you a digital code with 96 bits of information to it. It is modulating the impedance on the antenna, which does modulate the radar cross-section, the amount of signal that echoes. That's the way the thing talks to you, thoroughly passively. Requires no power to do it. It's a stroke of genius as to how an RFID tag works. So that, yes, as you change the impedance on the driven element of that Yagi antenna, as you go from short circuit to highly active to perfect of 50-ohm load to capacitive and so on, as you modulate that impedance, as you slowly change the impedance with your antenna tuner, so to speak. You've got an antenna tuner connected to this Yagi antenna. The other end of the antenna tuner is going to a dummy load. And as you turn the controls on the antenna tuner impedance, and you can now make the Yagi antenna in question see any impedance on its driven element that you want. You will see modulation of the radar cross-section. And will there be a dip when you get perfect impedance match? When the maximum amount of signal is being absorbed by the Yagi, will there be a dip in the reflected energy? The answer is yes. The thing that will amaze you, though, is the magnitude of the dip is nowhere near as deep as you would like. When the antenna has got a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit on its driven element, where it's absorbing nothing, you get a certain amount of scattering. You then go over to a perfect impedance match where it's now absorbing the most amount of signal it can. You're going to get a dip. It's not a very deep dip. The dip may only be 3, 4, or 5 dB. It's kind of amazing. A perfectly impedance match antenna is still, from a radar operator's, if you've got a very sensitive instrumentation radar aimed at that antenna, and you're trying to make its scattering area go to zero, you're going to be extremely disappointed. No matter what the heck you do, it's going to continue to scatter a hell of a lot of signal compared to a sensitive radar's capability to measure that echo. It's going to be scattering like gangbusters all the time. You will get a dip, but that dip is nowhere going to be as deep as you think. And it's going to be very disappointing if that was your theory of operation. No matter what heroics you use, if it is an antenna, it will scatter. And you'll be amazed how difficult it is to make it stop doing that. Almost impossible. KC2WGB, K2RAW, been there, done that.
Wow, energetic guy. Well, great response, Dick. Yeah, I was very interested in that question. It was something I never thought about before, and seems like you've done it, you've been there, and you agree. Okay. My next question is a very simple one, dealing with a dipole, and it has to do with the conversation we had about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Let me let it drop.
Net tonight at...
This young ham is having difficulty understanding the right-hand rule and applying it to the dipole. We have an open wire lead going up, and we have a lot of line feed in the dipole. We have a right side and a left side to the dipole. And he is having trouble understanding the right-hand rule and the circulating magnetic fields. Maybe you can give him a little better description, or maybe a little more lengthy than we covered, so that he understands that they are exactly the same on both elements.
Yeah, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, John, you and I privately off the TechNet had that discussion, and it's a frequently misunderstood area. Let me show you how the misunderstanding takes place. If I had a 70 ohm center impedance half-wave dipole, real good dipole, normal conditions, and I'm feeding it with 70 ohm twin lead. At one instant of time, the signal out of my transmission line, my twin lead, is positive on one side, negative on one side, at one instant of time. I'm launching positive voltage on the right-hand side of the dipole, negative voltage on the left-hand side of the dipole. In your mind, it sounds like it's out of phase on the right side with the left side. West, among other people, has said, does that mean at this instant of time the right side is the radiator and the left side is the counterpoise, and on the second half cycle the other way around? Good guess, no. That's not what's happening. If you look at it from a voltage point of view and you're putting opposite polarity of voltage, you think that that's what's happening. That is not what's happening. Let me drop for a second. Time's out, and I'll just let the machine reset. Okay. What's really happening is that the positive voltage coming out of your transmission line on the right-hand side is, assuming now the current is the movement of positively charged particles. During that half cycle, I am launching positively charged